桑耶曲当苏提扎那玛将曲巴杜达尼卡苏提达伊人苏里比苏南伊多拉本曲桑耶杜法修。
I go for refuge until I am enlightened. To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, by the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings.
I go for refuge until I am enlightened. To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints,
from the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from this. May all dwell in the world free from aversion and clinging.
The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwara Radhamanda Buddha Megha Samudra Saparana Samaye. Welcome. Before we go forward in the text, let's just find our spot where we are here. So we're working our way through the vision of experience and the enlightenment thought. We've covered the relative enlightenment thought. Now we're in the ultimate enlightenment thought. Last time we finished the section on calm abiding, I want to do a quick review of the end of that before we go on, and then we'll go on to insight wisdom. So we're in the ultimate enlightenment thought. And just a reminder, so that we're all clear, when we talk about something, we need to be sure whether we're talking about relative or ultimate, because we use different language. And sometimes if we're not clear, we can have confusion and so on. So right now we're in the ultimate. Okay? So I wanted to just review the last paragraph that we did last time for a couple of reasons. One, we're getting into some very advanced meditating here. And so we want to make sure we understand what we're doing, because as we mentioned before, and we'll mention it again, if you get into these advanced meditations and you don't do it right, you can end up in the form of the formless realm. And we don't want to do that. I spent quite a long time talking with Lama this evening before class to make sure that I got this right, so I can share this with you, because I don't know that it's necessarily evident just by reading it casually. Just to go back to 170 at the bottom, the last paragraph there. So just to lead up where we arrived in the calm abiding section, the text suggested to have an external object. It could be a statue or a picture of a Buddha. It could be a stone. Or it could be the blue flower that we talked about last week. But you have an external object and you're focusing your mind on it and you're learning to train your mind to extend your ability to focus, and then gradually your discursive thoughts just kind of dissolve. It's not that you try to force your mind to stop thinking, because we all know that doesn't work. But if you focus on your object and you don't follow your thoughts, like the stick dog, they'll settle, and then you get these big spaces between your thoughts. So that's what the meditation is about up to this point that we're going to review. So it says, if you're meditating in this way, when the functioning of thoughts disappear, then place the mind for a long time on the sparkling clarity of consciousness. So Lama and I had a long discussion about this because I wanted to make sure. So what that sparkling clarity of consciousness refers to, that phrase refers to the subtle mind. So normally we are operating in our gross mind, with, you know, our gross mind, what we call our gross mind, the monkey mind, the discursive mind. We think we have an ego, and we think all objects out there are real and solid and permanent, which, of course, they're not. That's how the gross mind functions. But that's not what is being talked about here. The sparkling clarity of consciousness is the subtle mind. When you stop all the gross mind, or you let it stop on its own, the clarity of the mind is always there. It's just that we don't see it. And so it has this quality of luminosity and a kind of sparkling clarity, is what this translation says. But Lama said that's actually the subtle mind. Now, without going too deeply into this, that's something that you don't want to grasp at, but you do want to focus on. So if we continue, it says, when one's meditation upon the sparkling clarity of consciousness becomes steady, one should not look on the meditation object, but strongly look at the clear appearance, radiance of mind itself. So we start out with an external object. We have a statue or a tonka or a stone or something. So our object is outside of us. But when our mind, we're training our mind to focus. We're training in calm abiding. But when we get to a certain level of calm abiding, and again, this is, we're getting more advanced here. When you get to a certain level, this clarity, you actually see this clarity, but it's not outside. And so when that happens, you want to shift your focus from your stone or your object that's external onto this clarity, onto this luminosity. Okay, that's the nature of mind itself. So look strongly at the clear appearance of radiance of mind itself. If one experiences this in the manner of singular clarity, then relax the mind upon this experience. As we learned earlier, you don't want to force your mind, you don't want to stress it. You don't want to make it do something, because it'll revolt. It'll get agitated if you do that. So once you have this experience of this sparking clarity, you want to relax into it, but you want to shift your focus from your external object to that luminosity. Okay? Do not reflect on the past, do not think about the future, and do not keep an account of one's present activities, but completely cut any conceptualizations, regardless of being good or bad, as they arise one after another. So if your conceptual mind arises during that focusing on clarity, don't follow it. Don't be the stick dog. Be the lion. Okay, just let it dissolve on its own, which it will, but don't follow it. Remain in the manner of being inwardly at ease, but outwardly attentive. So you're at ease, you're relaxed, but you're focused. You're not agitated, you're not sinking, you're not scattering, but you're focused on the clear light. And then when arising from the meditation session, part from meditation on good terms with it, dedicate the virtues for the sake of all beings, and so on and so forth. And then it says repeat it, short sessions repeated many times. We talked about that last time too. And then, having become habituated, prolong the sessions. Eventually, one should practice until one can pass a day and a night and so on in one continuous meditation session. So obviously, if you have enough calm abiding that you can have one session that's completely focused for a day and a night, you're a pretty good meditator. You're getting up there. So that's one of the reasons I think this text is so amazing, is you start from ground zero. If you remember back in the beginning, we started from, you know, the preliminaries. And now we're up into very advanced meditations here. And so now you have the blueprint, you have the roadmap. You can see where you're going with this. And another point about this is that when you become really good at this, you don't have to do any of the work. You just go into meditation spontaneously. You have, it's like anything that you've learned, you know, playing the piano or learning a new language. It's really tough at first. You have to sweat and work, and you don't get very far. But after a while, it just becomes kind of, you know, unconscious second nature. And this meditation is like that too. All this hard work that we have to do to get to that point, eventually you don't have to do all that hard work anymore. You just can sit down and spontaneously be in that state. Actually, not even sitting down. Lama told me just now that you can actually, once you attain this, you can actually do this while you're walking. Mm-hmm. I remember reading about one of these experiments, you know, these scientists that go over there, their Dharamsala, to measure these monastics with wires and electronic stuff, and Dalai Lama always is very generous, I guess, with giving a bunch of monastics to these scientists to, you know, be their guinea pigs. And so when they do these tests, you know, they always have a control group, the group that's not doing it. But this article that I read said that they really had a problem because these monastics, they're all trained in this, and so they cannot not do it. As soon as they sit down, they just automatically go into meditative state. And so the researchers were kind of at wit's end because they didn't have a control group. So there was nobody who could not do
get
it.
Get non-monastic.
Yeah, well, you talk to the Dalai Lama, I wasn't there.
That would be the option.
Jampa Shanaman, that a lot of us know is a translator here, he was one of those people. He's from Duncan, but he was over there doing a three-year retreat in the mountains, and they came up with their wires and stuff, and he knew the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama said, sure, test the Westerner too, you know. Jampa said, they tested me, but I didn't have any result at all, so they just left me. But anyway, the other thing about this clear light meditation is if you get into some very advanced death meditation practices, then that's where this is relevant, and you can actually attain enlightenment while you're dying, basically. You skip the bardo and become enlightenment. But you have to be at a certain level to do that. So I just wanted to kind of go through that because it's not necessarily evident, just kind of skimming that, what it's about. So does that help or is that more confusing?
Well, it's just something way in the future for me, so I'm not going to get my fingers in a twist about it.
Yeah, but if you're going somewhere, it's good to know the map.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I know too, but, you know.
Yeah, any comments? Or
one of the things that I was trying to do was keep my eyes open. Like, not open, but half open. I couldn't do it. My eyes would, I'd blink. Like, I just couldn't help it. Is that practice too? That it just takes time to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Many times it says do this again and again and again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If it was easy, we'd all be enlightened by now, right?
Yeah.
But it's attainable. So you can stay in samsara endlessly and suffer, or you can do the work and, you know, get out and help people, other people get out. But yeah, I mean, also where it says if your eyes start watering, don't wipe them away. I mean, how many times has that happened, you know? Eventually your physiology settles, though. Mm. And then your mind, eventually. If you do it right, like I said last time, it's not practice that makes perfect. It's perfect practice that makes perfect. That's why I like to teach people to do really, really short sessions and make sure you're doing it right. And then you can get longer. But if you do a big, long session and you're not doing it right, you're just creating a bunch of bad habits. That then you have another problem, which is getting rid of your bad habits to learn the good stuff. So it's normal that in the beginning there's some grinding of the gears. But you're doing it. That's the main thing. The effort, the karma's created, the seeds are being planted. If you just say, oh, well, this is too hard, you don't do it, then what? Okay, so that's the review from last time. So now we're going to go into this section here, section B, the nature of ultimate enlightenment thought, which is insight wisdom. Page 171. Okay, I talked a lot. Would somebody like to read?
Insight Wisdom. The Bodhisattva, who has attained the joy of one-pointed concentration of mind through meditating on calm abiding in this way, should then strive to
to master the ways which produce the discriminative understanding of insight, wisdom. The reason for this is that the true purport of all the sages' discourse is just that, wisdom. As it was said in the Bodhicharavatara, it was for wisdom's sake that the sage taught all these parts. Therefore, wisdom must be produced by those wishing to end suffering.
Wisdom, again, meaning discernment of the true nature of reality.
If one lacks the mind which thoroughly discriminates all entities, that is, dharmas, then no matter how diligently one meditates on emptiness or engages in the practice of the methods of giving and the like, still one will be unable to eradicate the afflictions and self-grasping from their roots. As it was said...
That's the collection of sutras.
Mm-hmm. How could even 10 million blind men who are ignorant of the way ever reach the city without a guide? So also, if wisdom is lacking, these 5 eyeless transcendent perfections cannot draw near to enlightenment because they have no guide.
Okay, so going back to the sentence that it says, dharmas, if one lacks the mind, thoroughly discriminates all entities. Dharmas, just again, dharma is one of these words that has lots of meanings. When it's capitalized, then usually that's the holy dharma. But here it's not capitalized. So this means entities or objects or phenomena. It's not the holy dharma that they're talking about here. So if you lack the mind which thoroughly discriminates all entities, so in other words, you have to do this analytical wisdom meditation that discriminates and discerns, well, what is the nature of objects? Is it really solid or is it impermanent? And the whole meditation, the analytical meditation that's taught here, that's what this dharma refers to. And then in the sutra quotation, it says, if wisdom is lacking, these 5 eyeless transcendent perfections cannot draw near to enlightenment because they have no guide. What are the 5 eyeless transcendent perfections? What does that refer to, do you think? Because normally we don't say 5, do we? What do we say normally? How many perfections are there normally?
6.
6. But they're saying 5, so
and
why...
Eyeless, what does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean? Okay, so first of all, let's find out what the 5 are. The topic here is wisdom, right? What's the 6th perfection?
Consciousness. No.
Generosity.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have a quiz.
Patience.
Morality.
Meditation.
Joyful enthusiasm.
Meditation.
Consciousness.
Loving kindness.
Contemplation and then meditation.
You're mixing the two lists. I know, there's a lot of lists. We're not talking about the 5 aggregates. We're talking about the 6 perfections. Mm-hmm. So let's... leave consciousness over in the aggregates, which is where it lives, and go back to the perfections. We've named 5 of them. What's the 6th one? Wisdom.
Wisdom.
Wisdom is the 6th perfection. So the 5 eyeless transcendent perfections are the first 5. And if you remember, when we talked about the perfections, the whole point of the first 5 is to gain the 6th. I mean, wisdom... as a word, as a title, that's basically what enlightenment is.
But it includes all the others. That's the thing. It's inclusive.
Yeah. But we need to understand these 5 are different than the 6th.
Mm-hmm.
So the first 5 are about merit. They're about accumulating merit, because you'll never have wisdom without enough merit. You can't. It's too fast. It's too advanced. The 5 eyeless transcendent perfections cannot draw near to enlightenment because they have no guide. Who's the guide?
Wisdom.
Wisdom is the guide, right? Okay. The ultimate enlightenment thought practice is to attain wisdom. It's to get it, to get the true nature of reality. We're in the advanced stuff here. We're really getting close to the diamond path to Vajrayana, as you'll see soon. We're at the sort of the height of Sutrayana, heading towards Vajrayana here. So it's important that we understand where we're going, where we are. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Also, it was stated in the same, without analytical wisdom to discriminate entities, there's no method to extinguish the afflictions. Lacking in that method, also, one roams here in this ocean of worldly existence. Hence, for that reason, the teacher taught this analytical wisdom.
Okay, so that's just a scriptural basis for what I just said, which is the wisdom cuts the afflictions, the method reduces them. It's like first aid, tourniquet, stop the bleeding. Yeah, that's what the first five do. They get us out of our crazy afflicted states, the three poisons, and it cools it, it calms it, right? That's what morality means. It means cooling down. So we cool it down so we can get a handle on things, and then, but it doesn't completely eradicate the root of delusion, which is this misconception, misapprehension that we have about ourselves and others and things. That's what wisdom does.
Hence we call it the sword of wisdom.
Yeah, that's why Manjushri has a sword, cutting the root. So it isn't just, you know, pruning the branches, but it's actually cutting the root. So we need both of these, and there's the famous example that a bird needs two wings to fly. We need wisdom. We need method and wisdom. So method refers to accumulation of merit, and wisdom refers to the realization of the true nature of reality. Is that clear? That was Vasubandhu who said that, by the way.
Mm-hmm. It is thus quite possible that even though one meditates on the view of emptiness unaccompanied by the practice of the extensive method, one would attain nothing higher than the enlightenment of disciples, Srivakas, and solitary Buddhas, Prakyata Buddhas. Thus it was said in the...
I don't have the translation.
Okay. In the sutra. One who lacks method and wisdom falls to the stage of disciples.
Okay, so this is, again, another distinction being made here. The practice of the extensive method... In Mahayana, there's kind of two traditions. There's one, I mean, this is one way of looking at it. You have what's called the extensive method, which is the Maitreya tradition. We've talked about Maitreya a few times, which really emphasizes the accumulation of merit, how you do that, how you practice, and so on. And the mind-only school is there because it's really focused on practicing. Then you have the other tradition of Nagarjuna, which is the analytical, logical, rational, kind of all these things that some of them are in here, but there's many more about analyzing and breaking down things, analytical meditation, which is the other tradition. So the extensive method here refers to the tradition of accumulating merit. If you just do that and you don't practice wisdom, or accomplish wisdom, you will attain nothing higher than the foundation path. According to Mahayana, they don't have the full big picture of wisdom. They have part of it, but they don't have all of it. That's one of the distinctions between the two, the foundation path and the Sutrayana path. Okay? Or the Mahayana path, I should say. Sorry, Mahayana path. So, if one lacks method and wisdom. One who lacks method and wisdom falls to the stage of disciples. And I'm just going to read the next one here because it's just a continuation. It's a Mahayana sutra. It's a deed of Mara if one comprehends the emptiness of each and every entity. yet abandons beings. It's also a deed of Mara if, although one analyzes this through wisdom, one still clings to the object of great compassion. So the bird needs two wings. If you only do compassion meditation, you don't have it all. If you only do wisdom meditation, you don't have it all. You need both. That's the bottom line. And then we get another quote from Nalanda Master Saraha. Do you want to keep reading?
Mm-hmm. By emptiness alone, where compassion has been discarded, one will not gain the supreme path. Yet, is there any liberation of existence if compassion be meditated alone? So one will not be able to transcend worldly existence because the root of viewing self-existence cannot be cut off by the mere meditation on emptiness, devoid of the realization of the two types of selflessness, nor by mental concentration, devoid of discriminative insight wisdom.
Okay. The two types of selflessness. Anybody know what that refers to? You want to take a guess? Two types of selflessness. So this is, we have talked about this, but this is kind of another way of saying it that's very common. The two types of selflessness is the selflessness of self, which is what we usually think of when we think of selflessness, right? Myself. The selflessness of self, selflessness is a phenomenon. Phenomenon includes you and the chairs. So everything that's out there that's not me is a selflessness of the phenomena. Those are the two kinds or types of selflessness. In the foundation path, they have one of those. They have the selflessness of self. I'm speaking very generally here. If there's any professors in the crowd, we could split hairs. But just to speak generally, they have the realization of selflessness of self. They don't have the realization of selflessness of phenomena. That's one of the distinctions, whereas Mahayana does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Do you want to keep going or do you want somebody else to read? Somebody want to continue there with a quote?
Okay.
To read for us, please? Anybody?
Where are we?
It says, even though worldlings...
Even though worldlings meditate on emptiness, by that meditation, the grasping at entities as real cannot be cut off. Instead, by it even more of the afflictions will be generated later, just as when Udraka meditated in transic absorption. Although Udraka meditated in transic absorption for 12 years, he was eventually reborn as a rodent.
Okay, so this is an example that I actually mentioned a long time ago, a famous example of a meditator who got very, very advanced, but didn't have this balance that we're talking about, the two wings. And if you get going in a certain direction, you don't have heart, you can end up being reborn as a rodent. So it's really important to get it right and also to have a good guru that can teach you.
Also, it was said in the Vasat Shantideva,
mm-hmm.
though conceptualization may be cut for a while, since the mind lacks the realization of emptiness, they will emerge again, as in the case of the meditation of non-perception. Therefore, one must meditate upon emptiness.
Okay, so the meditation of non-perception. So we've talked about the three realms, desire realm, form realm, formless realm. But within the form and the formless realm, there are levels, of course, subdivisions. And the meditation on non-perception is the fourth level of the formless realm.
The attainment of enlightenment requires these three factors to be present. Wisdom, which is like an arrow, compassion, which is like a bow, and a person well-versed in the right methods, who is like a skilled archer. As it was said in the Uttara Tantra.
Yeah, that's by Maitreya.
Having dispelled through wisdom all the craving for self, The loving one does not attain nirvana because of attachment to living beings. Thus, the noble one employed the methods of attaining enlightenment, neither remains in samsara nor crosses beyond into peace.
Okay, this is just saying what we've said many times, that we're taking the middle path. We're not going to be in either extreme, samsara being an extreme and nirvana being the other extreme.
Also, as was stated in
the
sutra.
Well, the Shiksha Samamucha is another text by Shantideva. It's not as famous as the Guide to Entering the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, but it is one of his texts which is still existent.
Through developing a realization of emptiness, which has as its essence compassion, one's merit becomes pure.
So this is another thing that we've talked about, is that all the practices that we do them with the right motivation, but they also have to be sealed with emptiness. If you don't seal your practice with emptiness, it's not really pure. And the other point here is that when you develop emptiness, you're going to be doing method and wisdom simultaneously because you have your two wings. But when you get really advanced in the emptiness side of it, the compassion arises spontaneously. You don't have to work on it. If you become very advanced, you realize that sentient beings, they don't have a clue what you're talking about or where you're at. The wisdom is so far from most sentient beings, and you need that wisdom to become enlightened, but it's just so far away from them that you just spontaneously develop compassion for them. So the development of wisdom sort of triggers or creates spontaneous compassion. Cool, huh?
For this reason, intelligent persons endowed with understanding who wish to benefit themselves should strive to master the ways of producing the wisdom that realizes selflessness, the remedy for suffering and its cause, and that too without being separate from the methods of great compassion. As was said by Shantideva, the causes of suffering, egotism, increases through delusion about the self. Were it argued, there is no means to discard it, the delusion about the self. It is said that the meditation of selflessness is the excellent remedy for it.
Okay, so all of this is kind of an advertisement for what's going to come now, which is to kind of emphasize the importance of what we're going to do here, which is the realization of selflessness. And now we're going to learn, well, how do you do that?
To ascertain this realization of selflessness, one has to, 1, recognize the nature of appearances, 2, keep the mind in the state free from conceptual extremes, and 3, develop the unshakable understanding that the nature of mind is inexpressible.
Okay, so now we're going to start off with the realization of selflessness, which goes on for quite a while. So just to keep track of where we are in the scheme of things, we're going to do the first section on the realization of selflessness.
Number 1, recognize the nature of appearances. One should understand that the appearance of outer and inner phenomena, which are mere appearance and without true independent existence, arise entirely through the power of the deluded mind of the viewer. In ultimate reality, there is not the smallest entity that exists. One may object by saying that it is not true that there are non-existent, because the existence of a self as the agent who creates happiness and suffering is accepted by non-Buddhists, and the existence of I and mine and the like are easily established without disagreement, even by the innate knowledge of ordinary folk. But this is not so. If there were a self, which is the object that is grasped in the manner of I, then one must inquire whether it happens to be a person's name, one's body, or one's mind.
Okay, so this goes back to the point I mentioned before about we need to understand if we're talking about relative truth or ultimate truth. So, it says here, in ultimate reality, there is not the smallest entity that exists. In ultimate reality. But then there's the objection, well, what do you mean? Everybody knows that there's I and mine and all this. That's because that person who objects is speaking in relative reality. And so we've got a disconnect here between these two categories. That's why it's important to know what you're talking about.
It is not the first of these three, since name is a mere conventional label and not anything that can be established as real. As it was stated in a sutra, the name is empty by the fact of just being a name. Names themselves naturally are devoid of a name. All phenomenon, that is dharmas, are devoid of a name. Yet by names are they denoted. Nor is the body the self, for if one were to examine it analytically, the body itself would not be found. As it was said by Shantideva, the body is not the feet, nor calves, nor is it thighs, nor hips. The stomach and the back are also not the body. Also the chest and shoulders are not the body. The ribs and hands also are not the body. The armpits and shoulders are also not the body, and the inner organs also not it. If the head and neck are also not the body, then among all these parts, which one is the body? If this body dwells equally among all its parts, then it is true that the body resides in each of these parts, but where does that body itself, without parts, reside? If the body as a whole resides in the hand and other parts, then there will be as many bodies as there are parts, such as the hand and the like. If the body does not exist either outside or inside, how is the body to be found in the hand and so on? Since it is not perceived separate from the hand and so on, how does it exist? Therefore, through delusion, there is the notion of a body in the hand and other parts, which are actually devoid of any body, just as there arises the notion of a man upon an effigy due to the particular arrangement of its shape. Therefore, if the body itself does not exist, how could it rightly be accepted as the self? As it was said in the same text, the self is not the nails, hair, and teeth, nor are blood and bones the self. Mind, too, is not the self, for if subjected to examination, the mind is not itself is not found. As it was said by Shantideva, mind does not dwell in the organs of sense, nor in forms and the rest, nor in between. Mind is to be found neither in nor out of the body, nor in any other place. Hence, since the mind itself is non-existence, how could it be acknowledged as a self? As it was said by Shantideva, the six consciousnesses are also not self. And again, in the same text, it was stated, past and future minds are not the self, for they do not exist. And supposing the present mind to be the self again, no self exists when it ceases.
Okay, thank you. What does it mean on the previous page at the last line there where it says the six consciousnesses? What does that refer to?
This taste, sight, hearing, touch.
That's five.
Mind
and mental consciousness. Yeah. So the five sense organs and the mental consciousness. Okay.
I would like someone else.
Okay. Somebody else want to take over reading?
Sure. Further, it was said in.
I don't have the translation.
That is. Name is not the self, for it is a mere imputation. Body is not the self, for the flesh and bones are a collection of elements like an outer wall. Mind is also not the self, for it is not an entity. If one investigates and meditates upon them thus, one will understand that these three, name, body, and mind, are not self. In this way, the delusive notion of grasping them to be the self will be reversed. Again, it may be asked, If there is no self, then what is the object that is grasped in the manner of I, even by innate knowledge of ordinary people? Through the power of habitually holding I upon the five aggregates, like misapprehending a rope for a snake, one grasps I with no fundamental reasons. Therefore, the object that is grasped in the matter of I or self does not exist.
Yeah, excuse me. So, this is a fundamental question. You say, well, if we don't have an I, how come everybody thinks we have one? And the simple answer is habit. If mind is beginningless, we've been doing this for a long time, and habit is very strong, and as we know, breaking habits is difficult. It's just a habit that we just all do. It's an assumption we all make.
Therefore, since there is no self, so also my does not exist. It is an error, therefore, to grasp these notions of I and mine, which are the roots of all misfortunes. Having firmly understood this by the analytic mind, one needs to practice diligently the method of reversing the belief in the self. As Chandrakirti said, having understood through analytical wisdom that all the faults of the afflictions arise from the view of holding the impermanent aggregates to be truly existent, and having realized too that the self is the object of that view, so the meditator rejects the self. So, too, one needs to gain an unshakable understanding through relying on scripture, reasoning, and the instructions of preceptors that just as no personal self exists, neither does there exist any external entity that is the objective aspect of the notion of the self of entities, as commonly imputed by the two schools of disciples.
Okay. So this is a critical stage we're at here of dissolving our attachment to ourself. And so we're being given several tools to do that. So we just went through an analytical meditation. Is it the name? Is it the body? Is it the mind? So that's kind of one set of tools in the toolbox. But we also have, we can rely on scripture, and there's tons of scriptural references. We can rely on reasoning, okay, if you think about it, and we can rely on the instructions of our preceptors, our spiritual friends, our guides, our gurus who are, you know, more advanced than us and teach this. And also, this isn't in the book, but you can add this if you want, you can rely on your own experience. That eventually, we start to break this horrible habit which causes us to suffer. We start to have the experience. We start to loosen our grasping. And we actually have our own experience because, as Buddha said, don't take my word for it. Go and try it yourself and see. Eventually we get to that point and we have our own experience. So we have at least four tools here that we've been given in this monumental task.
The manner of establishing this through scriptures is as was said in the...
This is the Exalted Ten Ground Teaching.
Okay, Dasabhumi Sutra. O sons of the Victorious One, all these three realms are only mind. Furthermore, it was said in Lankavaratatra Sutra.
Yeah, this is a sutra which was taught specifically for Sri Lanka students.
Since the mind has been agitated by mental impressions, external appearances arise. Outer appearances, by their own nature, do not exist, but are only of mind itself. So the perception of external phenomena is incorrect. Also, it was said in the... go ahead.
This is Nagarjuna's commentary on the Enlightenment thought.
Okay. Consciousness appears in the manner of subject and object. Apart from consciousness, not the least outer object exists. Further, it was stated in the...
This is Nagarjuna's 60 stanzas of reasoning.
The elements and so on that are explained in treatises are part of consciousness. By realizing thus, these external objects disappear. Therefore, are these not false imputations?
Okay, so all of that are the first category of scriptural understanding. And now we're going to go to reasoning.
The manner of establishing the validity of this insight through reasoning is to consider that these external appearances are not true because it happens that an existent thing appears not to exist, a non-existent thing appears to exist, a single thing appears to be many, and many things appear to be one. The first two points can be established by citing an example. Patient afflicted by a severe bilious disorder does not perceive the conventionally existent white conch, but instead perceives a non-existent yellow conch to exist.
Okay, so that's yellow jaundice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I thought it was a conch.
It depends. It's both.
That a single thing appears to be manifold is established by the consideration that a single entity that is known to appear to humans as water appears to beings of the hot hells as a floor of molten iron, while to beings in the cold hells it seems to be a mass of snow. Hungry ghosts see it as blood and pus. For certain animals it appears to be a drink, while still others see it as their home. The demigods perceive it to be a shield and weapon. The gods of the realm of desire know it as ambrosia, and the gods of the meditative sphere apprehend it as a transic absorption. To the gods of the sphere of space, it appears as space. To the gods of the sphere of consciousness, it is consciousness. To the gods of the sphere of nothing whatsoever, it appears to be nothing at all. And for the gods who meditate that all things are neither existent nor non-existent, it appears to be neither existent nor non-existent.
So how do we know that's all so? Do you believe it?
Well, I'll take it on.
On?
Faith.
Faith, okay. Faith is one way we know it's so. Or maybe our preceptor taught us that. That's how I learned it. My and I trusted the preceptor, never lied to me.
Well, that's what I meant by faith, is trusting the teacher.
Okay, right? It could be faith in scriptures too, though.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is that these are given, but we need to ask ourselves, well, why do I believe it? Well, I have faith in the Buddha's words. I have faith in the preceptor's teachings. Or I have faith in the scriptures, so...
But it's also from our own experience. I mean, that whole thing of, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder,
yeah.
Is exactly that.
Yeah.
You and I can look at the same thing and we're going to see something different.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
The fish doesn't see the water, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Although, I never asked them, so maybe they do.
They may not know what water is.
Yeah. Okay.
As it was stated by Arya Asanga, since a single object is seen differently in accordance with whatever class one belongs to, such as hungry ghost, animal, man, or God, it cannot be accepted to be ultimately existent. Also as said by Shantideva, who forged those floors of molten iron? Where did those assemblies of women spring from? All of these arose from the sinful mind, so the sage has taught. Further, it was stated in the same text, the actual existence of form and the like are popularly acclaimed to exist, but they are not established through valid knowledge. They are false, like impurity, and the like being acclaimed by worldlings to be purity and solemn. That may appear as one is also established, since a heap of many atoms assembled together appears to be a single mass, it may be asserted. Though the mass does not exist, indivisible atoms do exist, but these are non-existent. If one were to examine through analysis these non-divisible atoms by placing an atom in the center and surrounding it by atoms on each of its six sides, one could not find a non-divisible atom. Hence, it was stated in Vimsaka.
Yeah, the Vimsaka is by our friend Vasubandhu. Remember Vasubandhu? Yeah.
If conjoined by six atoms at one time, the most minute atom in the center has six parts, and even if all six exist in a single place, they become just a molecule or a mass. If an atom cannot be joined, so other atoms due to indivisibility, then what is that collection of atoms? You know, I just want to say this reminds me of a science show I watched, Nova, one night, and it was on quantum mechanics.
Uh-huh.
Yes,
going through
right.
the history of quantum mechanics, and it gets to the late 1980s when they finally have the technology to actually be able to, a telescope, a microscope so powerful that they can actually look into an atom. So then they show you in the atom, and of course what the scientists were expecting to see was a nucleus, a proton, and a neutron. But that's not what they saw. I mean, they saw what could be a nucleus, proton, and neutron, but there was nothing actually defining those three entities, those three phenomena, so they couldn't be distinguished from one another. So they were very confused about what they were looking at. And I thought, oh my God, they're looking at emptiness.
Yeah, yeah. Quantum physics is validating what Buddha said.
Exactly, totally.
He's saying,
right
I told
there,
you so.
You know, but these guys go, hey, what are we looking at? We don't get it. It was so interesting. Anyways.
Yeah.
This insight is also established by instructions. On the authority of all the profound instructions of the meditators and scholars of India and Tibet, which have been passed down in an unbroken lineage, it is only taught that all outer appearances, though they appear, do not exist.
And now, for me personally, this is the most convincing of the arguments. Yes, I have my experience and, you know, the rope that looks like a snake and all that stuff. But if all the masters in India and Tibet for 2,600 years said this is the way it is, okay,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to get to that point where I actually realize this, but I'm going to take their word for in the meantime.
And in the meantime, of course, we have had quantum physics and the dancing movie masters and the Della physics, and
yeah.
that's been very helpful.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Right. Yeah exactly.
Especially for the scientific oriented amongst us.
This can also be established through experience as follows. A great meditator of the path including its result.
Birwapa.
Teaching experienced thirst due to the activation of veins and airs in his body. He went out to drink water from a jug, a spring, and a river, but found no water in any of them. Doubt arose within his mind, and he returned to his seat after having left one of his robes on the other side of the river. When his sensations of thirst passed the next day, he saw that there was water in each of the places he had looked the previous day, and he had to cross the river in a boat to retrieve his robe. So it was recounted.
Okay, so this is one of several Virupa stories. Virupa and Birwapa are the same person. That illustrate this point. There's because he was such a great meditator, he had all this ability to manage his internal energy systems, you know, his channels and chakras. And all of our outside world is a reflection of this inside world. And these stories illustrate his experience of that. Do you remember the story where he went to the pub and he drank chong beer and he kept racking up a big bill and he said, don't worry, I'll pay when the sun goes down, and then the sun stopped. Remember that story? Well, we said that a long time ago. And everybody was getting worried. I mean, the innkeeper wasn't getting paid, but also it went on for days and the crops were wilting, the animals were, you know, falling over in the fields, and he's in the pub drinking beer. Eventually the king came, paid the bill, and he let the sun go. But the way he did that, the point of what I'm getting at is that he was controlling his inner red energy, his inner sun, which is the external sun is a reflection of that. And the proof of that is in the bardo, people don't have physical body. They can't see the sun and the moon. The moon is the white energy. The sun is the red energy. They cannot see the sun and the moon in the bardo. They don't have the bindus, that they're called, the drops, the energetic drops, which the physical body has. So this story of Virupa and the water and the beer and all that, the deeper meaning is that he had control over his energies, and the external world reflected that.
If one asks, well then, how do these various appearances come about? The answer is that these appearances rise from the full development of mental impressions of the deluded mind itself, just as, for example, the appearances in a dream. Thus it was said in Samadhi Raja Sutra, just like people who in their homes dream that they experience the joys of sense desire objects, but upon awakening do not experience the desire caused by them, since they know that it was only a dream. Likewise, all these things which are seen, heard, cognized, are unreal and like dreams. One may say, no matter how strong mental impressions might be, still it is impossible for them to be solid and remain so long as appearances do. But this is possible, as it was said in the Manjushri Vikravana Sutra. Manjushri was asked by Devaputra Padma Vikridita, Manjushri, how should one regard these outer appearances? Manjushri replied, one should regard them as having arisen by the power of full development of mental impressions of a conceptualizing mind. Devaputra then asked, how is it possible that mental impressions, no matter how strong they become, could appear to be so hard and solid as external entities are? Manjushri said, they do appear like that, hard and solid, just as, for example, in the case of a certain Brahmin in the city of Varanasi, who meditated his body to be a tiger. As a result, the townsmen also saw him as a tiger and fled, so that the town became empty. Also it was said in the of Sakya Pandita, that which appears as an external object is mind itself. Appearance itself has no external existence. Discriminating phenomena as true and false depends upon the firmness and weakness of mental impressions.
There's a meditation manual called Walking Through Walls, and great masters who realize emptiness, they're not inhibited by physical objects, and so the walls don't inhibit them, and also they can do all kinds of other things too. But the title itself states that it's not solid.
If one thinks, if external objects are unreal, is the mind which causes them to appear real, just as Sakaravadin school maintains? No, it is not, as Vasubandhu explained, because the object does not exist, there is no subject. It was also stated by Dharmakirti, neither consciousness devoid of an object, nor an object devoid of consciousness, is verified through experience. Therefore, they do not differ. Further, it was taught in the Madhya Maka Bharatara, in brief, understand this point, that just as objects do not exist, so likewise mind does not exist. Since no apprehensible object exists, so the mind, the cognizer, is also devoid of existence. The reason for this is that subject and object are established only through mutual dependence. Further, the meaning of the establishment of their mutual dependence is the very reason for their ultimate non-existence.
Excuse me, so I just, at the risk of repeating myself here, I just want to point out, you know, where we're talking here. When it says here it's devoid of existence, they're talking about ultimate reality here. Obviously it has an appearance, it appears to exist in the relative realm, but not, it doesn't exist in the ultimate realm. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thus it was said in the Madhya Maka Vairatara, it is taught by the holy that whatever is established as existing through mutual dependence is not truly existent. Therefore, one needs to understand and think that since beginningless time, though both subject and object are non-existent, still they are mere appearance, which arises due to the power of one's being habituated to dual appearance. In this way, the consciousness that is empty of subject and object is self-cognizing and self-illuminating, like a translucent crystal. This was explained by the great yogi Virupa as the clarity of mind, which is the defining characteristic of mind. This is also referred to as sphere of reality, Dharmahatu, in the Buddha's final turning of the wheel of the Dharma, as well as in its commentaries.
Okay, thank you. So just to go back and make sure we understand this here, it says subject and object are established only through mutual dependence. So this is another one of the reasonings that's used in this whole world here of exploring ultimate reality, that left only exists because there's a right. Up only exists because there's down. Hot only exists because there's cold. If you take one of them away, the other one doesn't have the label like it did before. And that is another way to kind of chip away at our hard, fast belief that everything is solid and I exist. We have to kind of work at it in a bunch of different ways, and this is one of the way. It doesn't exist because they're mutually dependent. That's the reason.
Mm-hmm. And hence we say it's relative. For example, the concept of east. Well, east is always going to be west of something.
Yeah.
So where is east exactly? Where's west, north or south?
Yeah. There's another part here I want to comment on. So in this way, the consciousness that is empty of subject and object is self-cognizing, self-illuminating like a translucent crystal. This was explained by Virupa as the clarity of mind, which is the defining characteristic of mind. This goes back to the very beginning of this evening's discussion, whatever page that was. The sparkling clarity of consciousness that we talked about at the beginning, the radiance of mind. This is the nature of the subtle mind. This is not the relative mind. This is the subtle mind that we're talking about. This clarity, the clear light, sometimes it's called clear light, like a translucent crystal. Lama said it sometimes appears like lightning at night. It's kind of a flash of kind of sparkle. But then you continue to meditate, then you extend that. It isn't just a flash, but you extend it, and the clear light becomes more of an extended experience. And that's sometimes called the sphere of reality or Dharmadhatu. Now, in this text, they're going to continually refer to the sphere of reality, so just put a little bookmark in your mind that that's what they're talking about, is this here, when they talk about the sphere.
As it was said in the Abhidharma Sutra, that sphere since beginningless time has been a substratum of all phenomena. Due to its existence, all beings and nirvana arise.
Yeah, so this kind of substratum, this clear clarity, which is empty too, of course, everything comes out of it. All of our thoughts, all of our projections of physical objects, my so-called ego, all that stuff comes out of that, but it's illusory. And when we detach from our grasping at it and just let all that illusion just dissolve, because it's not there anyway, what are you left with? You're left with the light, the clear light. And this is, as I said before, this is really important later if you want to get into advanced death meditations. You can actually become enlightened at your death. So that's why they're going on and on about this. It's an important topic.
Further was stated in the Sutra Lankara, having realized that nothing else but mind exists, know then that mind also does not exist. The wise know that both subject and object are non-existent and dwell in the sphere of reality which is endowed with neither. In the Sanskrit language, that sphere of reality is known as Dharmadhatu. Dhatu may convey the meaning of cause, sphere, or element. In this case, it indicates cause. For that cognizing, clear aspect of consciousness, which is the cause of all the phenomena of worldly existence, samsara, and liberation, nirvana, is the all-base consciousness, alaya vijnana. As it was said in the Vajrapanjara, this sphere of reality is peace supreme and hailed as the jewel of the mind. The dispenser of every fruit desired, naturally pure, is the true state of mind. This sphere of reality is also said to be clear light of the nature of mind. As it was said in the
8000 Stanza Sutra.
As for the mind, no mind exists, but the nature of the mind is clear light. If one knows the nature of that mind, one will know the nature of all phenomena of samsara and nirvana. Thus it is said in the Varokana Abhi Sambodhi, the conquerors explained that the transic absorption of all the enlightened ones is emptiness. That emptiness is obtained through the full understanding of mind and in no other way. Also, it was stated in the Ratnamegha Sutra, mind indeed is the precursor of all phenomena. If mind is thoroughly known, all phenomena will be known thoroughly. Again, it was mentioned in the Doha Kosa.
The Doha Kosa is one of the songs of experience by Virupa.
Mind alone is the seed of everything, and upon this samsara and nirvana issue forth. I salute the mind, which is like a wish-fulfilling jewel that bestows every desired fruit.
Thank you. So this description here is summarized in Sakya by the phrase the inseparability of samsara and nirvana. In other words, those two extremes that we talk about or live in, they all come from your mind. And when you realize that, you let go of both of them because you realize they're both illusory, and you stay in the middle path, which is the path towards complete enlightenment. We have to go through this meditational process of unraveling our endless attachment to illusions and break all that down in order to get down into this what they call the clear light, the nature of the mind, so that we can understand this on the meditative level, not just the intellectual level, but we actually have that as our experience. So we went through quite a bit tonight, and I think we'll pause here. We haven't finished this section, but let's pause here, and of course we have a week to integrate and meditate on all this, but let's stop now and do our dedication. Unless somebody has something else to say. Any comments that anybody's itching to speak? Okay, let's do our dedication then. So nam dehi tam jazi pani tom na ni bedanam pamjete ke gana chi balung trupeyi sipet sole do adu arsho Jung chu sem chu grim po che ma ke pa nong ke gu chi ke ma nyam par me par yam gong mi gong tu pel par shu jam pa pa wo ji tar ken pa da gun tu sang po de yang de shin te De da kungi jesu da loche Gewa di da tam che rab tungo Tu so she pi gawa tam che ki Ngo wa gangwa chu tunga pagi Dak shen gewe tsa wa di kung kyan Sang po chu chi ra tu ngô war gi Chak sa wa dang cho ching shak pa dang Je su yi rang gu jing so wa yi Ge wa chung ze da gi ji sa gu Tam che zo pe chak chu chu chu
By this merit may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the omni wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen, may it never decline when it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I might train to be like them.
Through this dedication, praise is supreme by the victorious Buddhas of all the past, present, and future. I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood.
May whatever virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.